process begins where the CO2 blood enters the heart. Through the tricuspid valve, through the right ventricle, the pulmonary artery and lungs. Once inside the lungs, it dumps its carbon dioxide, it picks up its oxygen supply. Then it's back to the heart through the pulmonary veins.
Welcome to the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast. Podcast 14, Dyspnea, End Diastolic Volume, British Nuclear Medicine Society Meeting, Part 1. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. I hope you're enjoying yourselves. We're going to have a sub-podcast, and that is simply another podcast that takes out episodes that are related to cardiac nuclear medicine, because I discovered that there's quite a large group of cardiologists, nuclear cardiologists, who like to listen to the podcast but aren't particularly interested in the non-cardiac section. So I'm not going to change the podcast at all, except just to add a sub-podcast. And if you look in the show notes for this week, so if you go to newcast.com, you'll see there'll be a link to another podcast and another feed that you can subscribe to your usual way through iTunes or through whatever podcatcher software you use, and that'll enable you to just get the podcasts that are of interest to you in nuclear cardiology. And so please pass that link on, particularly to your cardiologists who might happen to be your customers, or to you if you're a nuclear cardiologist, pass it on to your colleagues, because it'd be great to have that. And along that vein, I've just got back from ICNIC, that's the International Nuclear Cardiology meeting, and the ICNIC 8, it happens every 2 years. It was a fantastic meeting. There was just some wonderful speakers, and I've got some of the really world famous names on the podcast, so you can expect in the upcoming episodes you'll see lots and lots and lots of really good interviews with some leading lights from that area. So I'm really excited about that, and you're going to really enjoy the upcoming episodes. But before further ado, I'll take you straight to the meeting in Manchester for the British Nuclear Medicine Society, where I spoke to Dr. Clements, and he's from the Mayo Clinic. Here I am at the British Annual Meeting of Nuclear Medicine, and we've got a speaker here who just gave an excellent talk, and it's Dr. Clements from the Mayo Clinic. Yeah, Dr. Ian Clements from the Mayo Clinic, and so I'll just hand over to him, and he'll introduce himself and tell us a bit about himself and a bit about the work he does there.
My name is Ian Clements. I'm a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And my work involves mostly general cardiology, but I have an interest in nuclear cardiology, and I have been involved over the best part of 20 plus years in perfusion imaging, radionuclide angiography, and more recently, of course, PET perfusion and viability studies.
Your talk dealt with dyspnea, and dyspnea has become an important topic of late, particularly since some important papers have looked at it as a prognostic factor independently, and I believe it was also listed as an important factor in screening of diabetics in the DIAD trial as well. So I just wondering whether you could just give us a background of the sort of discussion that's gone on in the literature about dyspnea and cardiac disease.
Well, dyspnea, of course, is an important symptom in cardiac disease. We're all familiar with patients who develop acute shortness of breath with acute heart failure. But in a recent paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, The first author was Abakov, and it was from Berman's group in Cedars-Sinai. It indicated that if patients complained of shortness of breath, that these patients had a much worse prognosis than patients who simply complained of anginal chest pain or non-cardiac chest pain, period. And this was based on a simple questionnaire prior to doing stress perfusion studies. So these patients were not patients who had symptoms of dyspnea associated with severe left ventricular function. This study found that there was often a 3 to 6-fold increase in the mortality in patients with dyspnea, and this the significance of dyspnea also held up whether patients were diabetic or had hypertension or multiple other cardiac risk factors. So it is important now to get a history from patients that reflects the full spectrum of symptoms to try and evaluate prognosis in cardiac patients.
So this was shown as an independent risk factor for cardiac death or cardiac or all-cause death?
In the paper, it was actually an independent risk factor for all-cause death and also all cardiac deaths as well. And in actual fact, in the paper itself, the degree of ischemia, which of course they were able to estimate with perfusion imaging, did not indicate that patients were more likely to have shortness of breath. Patients who had shortness of breath had less areas of ischemia compared to patients who had anginal symptoms.
And those areas of ischemia, how was that assessed?
All these patients had stress perfusion studies, so it was based on myocardial perfusion imaging and the differences between rest and stress.
Now, if we get towards your paper, you looked at what sort of filling rate there is associated with dyspnea and what sorts of associations there were between filling rates and dyspnea. What did you find?
One of the things that the Berman paper, of course, had questioned was why was dyspnea such a striking predictor of mortality. And one of the things they did not assess, and which they mentioned in their discussion, was the role of diastolic function in patients and dyspnea. So the paper I presented today used radionuclide angiography to assess diastolic dysfunction, particularly the peak filling rate, and looked at the peak filling rate relative to symptoms, particularly the symptom of dyspnea. And when we looked at patients who had normal ejection fraction, we found that the peak filling rates were normal. The peak filling rates were the same whether patients had dyspnea or no dyspnea, and also the pattern of filling, whether there was a restrictive filling pattern or a normal filling pattern or a delayed filling pattern, the distribution of these filling patterns were similar in patients who had normal ejection fractions, that is, ejection fractions greater than 50%. Whereas if you had reduced ejection fractions less than 50%, we found that patients who had dyspnea, in fact, had a tripling of the incidence of restrictive filling, and also that the peak filling rate on average was much greater in patients who had dyspnea. So in summary, basically, dyspnea, particularly in patients with reduced ejection fraction, was a marker for restrictive filling particularly, and we do know that a restrictive filling pattern has a greater incidence of mortality. This has been both shown by echo studies and nuclear medicine studies.
I suppose the real question is it the chicken or the egg? In terms of, is the dyspnea through change in perhaps thoracic pressure affecting the filling rate, or is the diastolic dysfunction and the filling rate causing the dyspnea?
Well, the problem, of course, with dyspnea is that it's as a symptom, it's a very subjective symptom, and at least the questionnaire that I used to assess dyspnea and the questionnaire that Berman used did not really attempt to fully characterize the shortness of breath, nor did they really look at patients who might be expected to have wide intra-pleural pressure swings with respiration. These patients might be, of course, patients with severe COPD or emphysema, in which this would occur. But you are right that that changes in intrapleural pressure, of course, do affect both the filling of the right side and the left side of the heart. And there is some information from echocardiography, particularly when we're looking for respiratory changes with pericardial constriction. We have a lot of information on mitral inflow velocity, and at least in patients who don't have pericardial constriction and patients who have a wide wide differences in respiratory function, that the respiratory changes across the mitral valve don't change all that much in patients with normal lung function. But of course, we see marked changes in patients with severe COPD.
I'm guessing that your paper raises more questions than it answers in terms of where we go from here. At least we've got a measure. It's hard to measure breathlessness where we can actually measure filling rates. That's a start. But where do you think we need to go now to get a quantifiable number of some cardiac function that can help us link in with dyspnea to help predict future cardiac disease? And I think the early intervention and early medication in many of these things may be the answer in terms of helping reduce cardiac disease.
I think that probably the most important thing is to understand how relevant the clinical history that the patient gives, how important that is, since the symptom of dyspnea itself is much more predictive of outcomes than just angina alone. Now, whether how we can measure that in an absolute manner is unclear, and how this relates just purely to intracardiac function is also unclear, because as we know, dyspnea can relate to many things, be they central in origin, that is from the brainstem, or whether it's from the lungs themselves. In the paper of Berman, they also discussed issues of whether inflammation played a role in the cause of dyspnea, or relating dyspnea to symptoms, or relating dyspnea to outcomes. But it it's really hard to say where to go other than we should get better descriptions of the shortness of breath that our patients complain of.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm sure there's lots of questions yet to be answered and more research that needs to be done to tie together some of these factors. And thank you very much. Appreciate your time. We've only just started at the meeting, but are there any things that you're particularly looking forward to hear at the meeting that you think might be important?
Well, I'm particularly interested in how PET imaging from the cardiac viewpoint is progressing and how we can increase our sensitivities and specificities for detecting coronary artery disease with this new modality.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. I certainly did. And there's a lot more cardiac interviews coming up in the future. But the next episode won't be a cardiac interview. It'll be one with a physicist. And it really is of interest to everybody in nuclear medicine, including the nuclear cardiologist, because it really deals with selecting the right collimator and based upon some of the new reconstruction algorithms. And certainly from what I saw at IGNIC and elsewhere, this is really an important choice to make. So that's with Dr. Kapersky. So I'm sure you'll be very interested in that anyway. But come back next time, and it'll be about selecting the right collimator based on the reconstruction algorithm you're using. So I'm sure you'll find that interesting. Until then, see you next time. Bye.
There's a larger vena cava to the atrium and lungs, then we're back to where we started in the heart. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.